Okay, so this evening we're looking at spiritual death and rebirth. And I thought I'd start off with a poem. And I said the word poem and everyone starts. It's not that long. Busy with many jobs, I forgot one also has to die. Irresponsible, I kept neglecting that duty, or performed it perfunctory. As from tomorrow, things will be different. I'll start dying meticulously, wisely, optimistically, without wasting time. I do like that poem a lot, partly because it talks about dying meticulously, wisely, and optimistically. I think sometimes we forget that spiritual death can sound quite, you know, harsh and frightening. But actually, maybe we could look at it as something optimistic. We're letting go of the old and bringing in something new. So we've talked about integration and positive emotion. We've talked about becoming responsible and creative. And then we've talked about spiritual receptivity and being open to something more. But even spiritual receptivity isn't enough. In Sangharakshita's words, the happy, healthy individual which you now are or were must die. not literally. I mean, I'd hope that wouldn't be the point of actual death. But it's the ego project, it's delusion. It's that self-object dichotomy that dies, or at least is chipped away. Self-orientated clinging has to die. So Subhuti goes into the mechanics of this very well. He talks about how in every experience there's a subjective and an objective pole to our experience. And we make that subjective and objective pole real and substantial. And fixed and separate. He talks about the grasper and grasped and me and mine. The way that Sangharakshita talks about this, which is quite... I hardly ever remember to bring an elastic band when I do this, and I think this is the first time ever, so I'm just going to experience the joy of doing that. Anyway, he talks about it, he says it's a bit like you've got an elastic band. And with the elastic band, you've got a knot in the middle, and on one pole, you've got the subjective experience and clinging to a sense of self-identity. And on the other pole, you've got an experience of other, of the object. And you relate to the other either in terms of aversion or in terms of grasping. But you can never quite fit to the other because there's a knot in the middle. So you're either pulling away or you're moving towards. But fundamentally, your experience is divided into self-other and other. And what Sangharakshita says is it's not that when you're enlightened you stop experiencing a subjective and an objective pole to experience. Because otherwise you wouldn't be able to operate in the world. You wouldn't be able to eat. You know, you've got to have a sense of a kind of person eating in order to eat. So he says what actually happens is you just loosen that distinction. So you've got a subjective and an objective pole to experience, but they're freed up, they're opened, and there's a sense of the wholeness of experience. You cease to identify solely with me and the subjective pole. And what happens if we release that subject-object dichotomy, that divided consciousness? Well, we enter into that kind of wholeness. It becomes more fluid or open. It becomes shunya, empty of division and tension and conflict. And one of the things that they're very clear about in all the Buddhist texts throughout the ages is that it doesn't feel like a loss. Because you're releasing yourself from the delusion of opposition. You've never had it, so why would you grieve? So there's a beautiful passage from the Sutta Nipata where the Buddha talks about this. He says, When someone does not identify themselves with mind and matter at all, when they do not grieve for what does not exist, they cannot sustain any loss in this world. When they do not think, this is mine, or that belongs to them, then, since they have no egoism, they cannot grieve with a thought, I do not have. So we do not grieve for what does not exist. It's not like there's a thing that we've lost. What we've lost is a mistaken idea. So in another context, Sangharakshita says, it's not like you try and get rid of the ego, or something like that, which, you know, is quite a harsh way of looking at it, because the ego is my self-identity, you know. He says, you just forget about it. It's just a mistake. It's just a mistake in your way of thinking. So this is what we're doing. We're opening up this this delusion when we're moving from spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. And we have to have this perspective all the time, because working with karma niyama isn't an end in itself. It has to lead to dharma niyama. It has to lead to the dharma niyama processes. Otherwise, there's something that always gets in your way. It always springs you back, and that's the gravitational pull of the self. Sangharakshita says it's a bit like, you know, you're trying to develop integration and positive emotion, particularly positive emotion, even receptivity, and he says it's like you're shooting out a rocket out from the earth, but it gets so far, and then it just starts orbiting the earth in the gravitational pull of the earth. And he says it's a bit like that, developing within the five aspects. It's like you're trying to change and grow. You're trying to transcend in a way, but you always come back to, you sort of get so far and you can't get any further because you're just rotating around the gravitational pull of the self. And it always basically comes back to me. Sometimes we can experience this. It's quite painful, actually. I think after 20 years of doing solitary retreats, I think the pinnacle of my experience is I've really got in touch with my true unadulterated selfishness. You know, that's what I've really discovered. And it's like, I get sit down in solitary, you know, first 3 days of sleep, then I have a nice little kind of comforting phase, and then it's like, oh, here we are again. You know, this is the gravitational pull of the self, because I can practice and practice, but when it comes down to it, it's always me first. Actually, I think that's something to rejoice in, because I've sort of seen the majesty of what I'm taking on. And I have this strange happiness in finding how ridiculous and delusional and unselfish I am. So what does it mean to have the perspective of spiritual death and rebirth all the time? I think what it means is keeping alive a sense of dukkha, a sense that we could go further, a sense of suffering, or unsatisfactoriness, a sense that we're always being called by the call of shunyata, unconditioned and unconfined, and that in a way, it's not enough. You know, sometimes, you know, we need to encourage each other and say, well, you know, you're doing enough, particularly if you've got a tendency to overwork. But actually, from a spiritual point of view, we're not, really. So we can have this sense of, actually, we're practicing at a certain level, but this isn't enough. This isn't as far as we can go. Dharmadina, who's on the refuge tree, the Dharmadina of the Pali Canon, she talks about this as, why have I not reached the liberation of the noble ones? And how this dukkha is a dukkha of the path. It's spiritually positive, but it's painful to experience. So we're always keeping alive the sense of, why am I not one of the noble ones? You know, what else do I need to do? And it's painful, but it's positive. And he says, it's only when the conditioned individuality dies that the unconditioned individuality dies that the unconditioned individuality as we can call it, begins to emerge. So what we're leaving behind is a conditioned individuality to an unconditioned individuality. So we need to feel that we could be more. There's always this sense, there's something in me that's conditioned, there's something in me that's confined. And there's a kind of longing to be something more than that, to be unconfined, to be limitless, to be unconditioned. And we need to make space for that to emerge. And of course that's uncomfortable because we don't know when we make a space for something to emerge, what will emerge in that space, if anything. You know, we've got to be ready to just go with the process, whatever that process is and however long it takes and wherever it takes us. The Sufi analogy for this is, they say that to find the pearl of wisdom at the bottom of the ocean, we have to drown knowledge at the seashore. And I really love that image. It's like knowledge can take us so far. Positive emotion and integration and spiritual receptivity can take us so far. They can take us to the shore of the ocean. But we have to be willing to drown if we're really going to find the pearl of wisdom. So in some sense, it's a journey into the darkness. But actually what we find is necessarily more wonderful than we could possibly imagine. I say necessarily because what we imagine is necessarily limited by our limited consciousness, by this structure of consciousness which is divided between self and other. So when we try and imagine enlightenment, we're always imagining it from this point of view. We're always imagining it from a divided consciousness. So what it ends up with is when we imagine enlightenment, we either imagine it as completely other than us, or we imagine it as ourselves, but much cooler, like much better and more wise and more attractive and kinder and, you know, like the wise old sage me. You know, so we're always trying to imagine it from this kind of limited point of view. And yet it's important that we do try and imagine it. We do try and imagine it, but know that it's not ever going to be as we imagined it. Another quote from Arloka. How tedious if Dharma practice always conformed to what we expected, and our naive bletherings about enlightenment bore even the remotest relationship to its eventual realisation. I mean, think about that. Wouldn't it be awful if enlightenment was actually like we thought it was going to be? You know, it's much, much more than that. Much more than that. Remember, I did a period, quite a long period of doing the Buddhanusati in the traditional style where you go through the qualities of the Buddha as found in the Tiratnavandana. There was one that just really got me every time, which was Sugata, beyond any kind of known destination. And there was something about that, you can't say, it's the kind of great mystery. You can't confine him by making him into something that you know already. And I think when I go to the Bodh Gaya and to the Mahabodhi temple where the Buddha gained enlightenment, I really get that sense. You know, you're sitting there with the mystery that all these people are relating to, and they have done for 2,500 years. And you realise that your idea of, or I realise that my idea of enlightenment is so narrow compared to, you know, what it really would have been. So spiritual receptivity is being receptive to what brings us alive. We've talked about that in our groups. But spiritual rebirth is being receptive to more than just what brings us alive, but to being receptive to the transcendental subject and object. I'll say a bit more about that. So spiritual rebirth is being receptive to the transcendental subject and object, and letting that bring us alive. So we're receptive to something beyond ourselves. The Dharma is envisaged beyond our limited consciousness. We're receptive to something that embodies the transcendental, which in Pali is Lakutra, beyond the world. And yet we're also being receptive to something that is ourselves in potential. We're receptive to something that fulfills a deep longing within us. I think my earliest experience of this kind of receptivity, of being receptive to something beyond myself, was definitely in cathedrals when I was a child. And I used to really love church music. Well, I still really love church music. But I remember when we used to go to Downside Abbey with all the chanting, with the monks would come in chanting, and their great big incense, you know, we'd clock someone over the head with that, which they didn't. But anyway, so calm down, and then this chanting, and I just knew there was something more than this. I just knew it, and whatever state I was in, I was just lifted out of that. And of course, I think I get that same sort of feeling when I imagine my Yidam. So Yidam is the Buddha or Bodhisattva visualization or meditation that one takes at ordination. And the Yidam embodies both the sort of transcendental object and the transcendental subject. So in one sense, it is us in our potential. So I do the White Tara practice. And in one sense, yes, White Tara is, Sagaracharya calls your Yidam a mirror of your potential. It's a sort of mirror of who you could be. And it's very important to relate to White Tara on that basis. That's what I'm trying to become. She has a relationship to me. She's not separate from me. There's a wonderful passage in the Itivutaka from the Buddha where he says, "Bhikkhus, I am ever accessible to entreaties. Open-handed, I bear my last body. I am the supreme physician, the supreme surgeon." And then he says, "You are the children of my breast, born of my mouth, born of the Dharma, fashioned by Dharma, heirs of Dharma, not heirs of material things." And I find that profoundly moving, to think of myself as an heir to the Dharma, not an heir to material things, and being born of the Buddha's breast, being born of the Buddha's body, of his mouth. And in that sense, you know, when I'm in relationship to Tara, I'm born of Tara. I'm born of the Buddha. I'm devoting my life to the Buddha Dharma. And from that sense, I'm part of his family. In a way, he is giving birth, the Buddhahood is giving birth to sort of new me. And yet the Yidam is also an embodiment of the Dharma. It's not just me in potential. It's not just us in potential. It's also embodiment of the Dharma itself, and it reveals the mystery of the Dharma slowly. So I know there's a story from, I think it's Tenzin Palmo, and she's a Western practitioner in the Tibetan tradition, and she's a nice woman, actually. I've met Tenzin Palmo, she's quite feisty. Anyway, she was doing the Tara practice, and she went to her teacher, and she said, "Well, you know, I'm a Westerner, so Tara, for me, Tara has blonde hair." The teacher nods, and he says, "Yeah, no, Tara has black hair." And she said, but I'm imagining enlightenment in a kind of, and I've got a Western understanding of that, so Tara has blonde hair. Tara has black hair. And he said, Tara exists from her own side. And I think what this means is, it's a bit like with the refuge tree. We can limit ourselves if we decide, well, you know, the refuge tree, you know, let's face it, it's only got two women on it. So my refuge tree is going to have more women that I like on it. And I'm going to change this and this and this. And, you know, I'm not really into the Tibetans, so I'm going to replace them with someone else. Yeah. And, you know, I don't feel very comfortable with Bhante. So it's not. If you start changing the refuge tree can't teach you the symbolism of the refuge tree. There's something about the refuge tree which is you're confronted by something beyond yourself. It's beyond your ego writ large, basically. And that might make us feel uncomfortable at times. You know, maybe it will make us feel uncomfortable that Tara has black hair and not blonde hair. But we have to keep going with it. I mean, it will be like saying, you know, in the prostration practice, well, my mum and dad aren't there because, you know, they're Christians and they wouldn't do that kind of thing. And I don't think it's fair to put Muslims in prostration practice bowing to the Buddha because they wouldn't like it. In a way, well, then you're missing out on the vision that that practice is communicating. So, in the way they talk about it in the Buddhist tradition is with the yidam or sadhana practice, which is the practice of the yidam that you take up. You first of all develop the samaya sattva, the body of the bond. You make a bond, you make a commitment, the body of commitment, the being, sorry, of commitment. So first of all, you develop the kind of being of commitment. You make a commitment to visualize something in a particular way that has been handed down to you from your teacher. So it's coming from beyond you, basically. And if you do that, what emerges is what's called the jnana sattva, the being of wisdom. And when you experience the jnana sattva, it's like those figures or that figure is filled up from its own side. It feels like something is coming to you from outside of you, from outside of your consciousness. Actually, it's not quite like that. It's just it's coming out from outside of your known consciousness. It's coming from outside of your limited consciousness. So necessarily, it feels like it's coming from outside of you into you. You feel like it's coming from outside and taking you over. And you surrender to that. So I think what we can look at with spiritual death and rebirth is this, that what we're doing is surrendering. Surrendering is a big part of that. And there's, I don't know if anyone's seen the film Of Gods and Men. But it's a wonderful film. You really should see it if you haven't seen it. There's a bit, there's a community of monks in Algeria in the Atlas Mountains.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And there's this one bit where there's this elderly monk, and he's sitting by this wall, you know, just relaxing in the sort of late afternoon sunshine. And this young woman, very pretty young woman, comes up and starts talking to him. He says, "Oh, what's happening with you?" And she says, "Oh, I've fallen in love." And you know, and she seems like that. She's got that look of a young woman in love, beautiful, you know, just like a kind of opening flower. And he says, "All right." And she said, "Have you ever been in love?" Which is quite a thing to say to an old monk. And he looks wistfully into the distance. He said, "Oh yes, I've been in love many times." He says, "But I gave up all lesser loves for a greater love." And there's something in that moment which is so precious. You know, he's given up all lesser loves for a greater love. It means that, you know, his practice of renunciation wasn't a kind of diminishing of self or kind of grief-stricken or painful. Actually, he was released into something larger. And that's very much what I think of when I think of spiritual death and rebirth. You're giving up all lesser loves for a greater love. You're giving up the love of the Atma or the Atma kleshas, the sort of inward-looking, self-cherishing, to the love of Buddhahood or the Bodhisattva. So spiritual death and rebirth is talked about as part of the process that has to be happening all the time in our Dharma life. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to participate fully in that process at ordination, because, you know, traditionally at ordination we say is a practice of spiritual death and rebirth. And the ordination process is to prepare you for that spiritual death and rebirth that happens at ordination. And in a way, what we're doing here is we experience reality. We're experiencing a deeper reality, a deeper wisdom, and we're letting it descend and transform every aspect of our being. We're stepping out from an old identity into something much larger. We're stepping out of an old identification with our restricted habits. And as I said before the other night, it's sort of identification with a kind of lonely heroine doing it alone. Into something much larger, which is a sense of relatedness, of being on a journey with others. We're stepping out into a relationship with our own spiritual potential, and a relationship with the Sangha, and a relationship with all beings, and the potential for all beings to be enlightened. So that's what we're doing, and we're challenging our whole structure of reality. We're challenging that self-other dichotomy. Because if you open up the self-object dichotomy, if you're opening up that kind of restricted and divided consciousness, what you end up with is a sense of relationship with life itself, and everything that goes on in life. What we're not doing, and I think because the language of spiritual death and rebirth can be a little confusing, what we're not doing is swapping our old unsatisfactory self for a new satisfactory self. So in a way it might be experienced like this at some times, but sometimes people think that it's spiritual death and rebirth if you think you're not very good at art. But now you've gone to a drawing class and that's spiritual death and rebirth. Oh, that's great, that's the development of the individual, and it's probably quite a lot of positive emotion and integration, but it's not spiritual death and rebirth. Or sometimes spiritual death and rebirth is talked about as coming through any bad experience. So anything that's painful or difficult is spiritual death and rebirth. But actually, it could be spiritual death and rebirth. It just depends on how we relate to it. For example, a period of illness or a period of suffering or loss can be experience of spiritual death and rebirth. But it can also be another excuse to just distract ourselves. It depends how we use it, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. So we talk about it as something that we need to develop at every level of our practice and preparing for ordination. But we can limit ourselves if we think this is the end. I think there's a modern message about enlightenment, which is, to make people feel more encouraged. Enlightenment is talked about as being very ordinary. Well, it's just an ordinary experience. Well, in some ways... it can end up with enlightenment is just very ordinary, or stream entry is just very ordinary, or insight is just very ordinary, and the Buddhas and Bodhisattva figures and the rainbow clouds and all the magic and mystery are just fantasy. Perhaps it's better to say that these experiences are anticipations of the spiritual death and rebirth that happens when transcendental insight arises, when the bodhicitta or enlightenment arrives. Because that's what we're aiming towards. So it's a bit like the little deaths and rebirths are anticipations of something much larger that can be possible. There's always further to go. And even for the Buddha himself, when you go to the Mahabodhi temple, there's all these different sites around the temple complex. And what they're marking is all the different stages of the Buddha's enlightenment process as he sat underneath the Bodhi tree and reflected on his experience. So you don't get the impression that he was just sitting there and then he got it and that was it. Actually, what you see is that process that unfolded over weeks. His experience unfolded over weeks and went into different directions in terms of wisdom and compassion and energy. So Visantra is very good on this. He talks about insight and post-insight and things to reflect on. And he talks about three kinds of spiritual death and rebirth experiences. So the first one he talks about is decisive insight. And this is when you really experience the ending of self-clinging and the bodhicitta emerges. And he says, actually, that's quite rare. But even if that happens, even if the bodhicitta does arise within you, there's still more to explore from the transcendental point of view. So do remember that with the Noble Eightfold Path, there's the mundane and the transcendental Noble Eightfold Path. And included in the transcendental Noble Eightfold Path is perfect effort. You know, so it's not like one just gets to transcendental insight and then no one has to make any effort before, even after stream entry. There's a sense that one is also practicing ethics and still on the Noble Eightfold Path. So there's decisive insight, but there's also what he calls clear insight. And this is when one has a kind of non-conceptual insight into the nature of reality. But once you're out of that actual experience of a non-conceptual insight, a subtle dualistic structure returns. There's a subtle version of your habitual functioning that returns. But he said when the conditions are right and when you actually go into your non-conceptual experience again under the right conditions, you can look directly back at that non-conceptual insight, if you see what I mean. So under the right conditions, you can go back into it. But when you're actually out of that direct experience, there's a subtle dualistic function that happens. So again, you have to make sure that you can get into the conditions where you can experience it directly. And then he also talks about something called genuine insight, but that fades and becomes a memory. This is when we have a genuine insight, a genuine experience of spiritual death and rebirth. But our dualistic functioning reasserts itself. And that insight is not available to us all the time. Mainly you fall back into your habitual tendencies. And I think it's that third kind that people can really struggle with because the memory is so powerful, but the experience is gone. And I do remember in Sheffield, there was a man who came to the centre who'd had a very, very genuine experience of spiritual death and rebirth. And it was wonderful. It was absolutely beautiful. But it had gone, and it became a memory. And it was a memory that he always wanted to get back to, but couldn't find. And what was interesting is he came to the Buddhist centre and he refused to meditate. He just wanted that experience back again, but he didn't want to do any work to find it. So he went on this kind of tour of all these kind of gurus throughout India and even the West, for someone who would give him that insight back again. But he was telling me about going to India and going to these ashrams, and he'd always find a local boy who he'd pay some money to so that the local boy could sneak him in some alcohol, and he wouldn't bother to meditate. So it was really interesting. It was like his whole life was referring back to this memory, but he wouldn't put the conditions in place by which he might have that experience again. It's absolutely fascinating. So one of the things that Vasantra says, he says, people in whom bodhicitta has arisen, who have opened their hearts completely and offered themselves to the service of the Dharma and all beings, who are receptive to the universe, so that the blessings of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are everywhere, who feel inseparable from all life, who are sensitive to every beautiful, impermanent, magical moment of experience, never shrug and think, is that all there is to it? You know, we're talking about something very, very profound, actually. And Sangharakshita talks about this as well. And there's a clip where he's talking about there was obviously some weekend courses and weekend to enlightenment courses. And he said, we're talking about a complete transformation of being. You're not going to have that on a weekend. You've got to put in some serious work, you know, for that to happen. So, yes, so in some sense, we need to think of it as a path, and we need to have that sense that there's always further to go. But that can set up an idea that once you've experienced spiritual death or rebirth, you can just leave the rest of the path behind you. And it can also sometimes make us feel a bit discouraged that it's always a bit further away. It can also lead us to think that, you know, if we think someone's further along the path than us, they should be sorted in all their areas of their life, you know, because they're further along the path. So they should have done positive emotion integration before. Actually, it's not quite like that. I don't think the path is sort of linear in that sense. And we've all got a lot of work to do on integration and positive emotion all the time. In a way, what we're trying to do is make ourselves a bigger vessel. So in some ways, we could look at the path as more like you have a spiritual vision, you have the perfect vision, and then you've got to transform your life in the light of that vision. And that will give you more vision, and then there's more transformation to do, and more vision, and more transformation, and more vision, and more transformation. If we're looking at it as a mandala, it's that all the parts of the mandala inform each other. They're all influencing each other. The more positive emotion there is, the more spiritual death and rebirth. And the more spiritual death and rebirth there is, the deeper and more sustained the positive emotion. You could even imagine it as a mandala filled with dancing light, reflecting off each other. So that's the process of spiritual death and rebirth. But what holds us back? Well, the thing that holds us back is the desire for security and order, for safety, to have control in our lives. So we make the Dharma something that is a kind of tool to make us feel better about ourselves and to add on to ourselves. And we build ourselves a kind of good Buddhist life. Because what would happen if we let it go? What would happen if we stepped into that spiritual death and rebirth? And one of the ways of looking at this is literalism. So Sangharaksha defines literalism as having an idea of the Arya Pariyasana, the noble quest. So having an idea of the noble quest, which we grasp with the intellect, powered by craving. So we grasp after an idea of the spiritual life that suits our world, that suits our craving, so that we don't really have to change. So for example, if we don't like ourselves very much, we imagine the spiritual life as being quite hard or urgent or cutting or some sort of, I don't like myself, so I'm going to improve myself. We sort of see the Dharma as self-improvement in that way. Or if we feel we need a bit of looking after, the spiritual life is all about kind people looking after us. It's all about the positive group. And we don't want to enter into anything that might shake up our idea about what the Dharma actually is. So we've always got a resistance in anything that's going to take us out of our structure of reality, of our intellect powered by craving. So, you know, that's why Subhuti ends his talk on spiritual death with a real call of, is this what you really want? You know, do you want to step beyond that comfort? In a funny kind of way, I can't imagine why anyone would want to do that. You know what I mean? It's not something that you think, yeah, great, I'm gonna really see through my ego clinging and step into Buddhahood. I don't think it's quite like that, because if you did, you'd think, I wonder what's going on there. I think it's more that we enter onto the path and we've got to let it take us. And we've got to let it take us to places that we're frightened of and into places that we haven't imagined before. And we've got to give ourselves to that process fully. And we've got to bear some humiliation along the way. So how do we do that? Well, I'll talk about the sort of practice of spiritual death and rebirth in terms of sort of mind, heart and guts, the cognitive, the emotional and the volitional. So in terms of the cognitive aspect, we practice spiritual death and rebirth by bringing in reflection. So we reflect on the Dharma. And to reflect on the Dharma, that means we have to know the Dharma. The Dharma's not tremendously complicated. I mean, you can make it very complicated. But actually, the things that you're going to reflect on aren't that complicated. They're things like the three lakshanas. And, you know, it's good to discuss in our groups how we're going to reflect on the Dharma. I mean, for me, I think it's very important for me to learn texts off by heart so that they're turned around in my mind. I think I've got a bit of a catastrophic imagination and I keep thinking that one day I'm going to end up in prison or unable to read or, anyway, we're in a war and everything's taken away from me and I want to have it in my mind what I'm going to reflect on. Anyway. And so it means actually, listening to the Dharma, memorising the Dharma, keeping it turning over in your mind. And then we have to reflect on the Dharma when it matters most. So, you know, it's easy to reflect on impermanence when we're looking at the daffodils or a sunset. But actually, that's not going to really challenge the structure of our reality. It won't challenge our basic self-clinging. What's going to really challenge our basic self-clinging is if we bring to mind the Dharma in emotionally charged situations when the self is at threat. So that's when we suffer. And in terms of suffering, do you want me to open the window?
Yes.
Okay, let's switch on some. So yes, suffering. So when we suffer, when we experience betrayal or disharmony or disappointment or failure, that's the time when we've really got to reflect on the Dharma. That's the time when we've got to make those things a real opportunity for practice. So Sangha actually talks about the difference between a difficulty and a problem. What happens with it when we make those things a difficulty is that we try and solve them on their own terms. You know, there's a disharmony going on, so we just try and appease people, you know, so that they're not fighting anymore. Or someone betrays us and we just exclude them from our lives. So we just make it a kind of practical problem that we're going to solve on its own terms. He said, actually, what you can do is you can make these things a spiritual problem. And by that, it means a spiritual problem is when you can't make something better on its own terms. You have to transcend the consciousness that gave rise to that in the first place. You have to transcend the consciousness that created the problem. You have to transcend the divided consciousness. So, for example, I think a lot of the stuff about expectations around the Sangha comes into this. Because on one level, we could just try and sort it out. You know, appease that person, stop them fighting. Or, for example, you know, when we come across the things that Panti has said or done that we don't like or approve of, we can think, well, I'm just going to exclude him from the order. You know, I'm going to exclude him from the Dharma, I'm going to exclude him from the refuge tree, he's just not my thing. That's making it a difficulty, but what we can do is we can make it a spiritual kind of problem by saying, well, I can't dismiss Bhante because he's given me the gift of the Dharma and he's given me this order and this Sangha, which is very, very precious and an expression of his understanding and his translation of the Dharma. So on the one hand, he must know something. And yet, I can't condone all his actions and make him perfect. So we see this in the order, actually, particularly over the last couple of years. Well, forever. But, you know, there's some order members who just try and say, well, we've outgrown Bhante and it's time we just jettisoned him off, you know, out of the order, and we'll sort it out ourselves. And then there's some who try and just excuse it, well, you know, it's not really that he was unethical and, you know, what he did was fine. But actually, that's a way of trying to just sort out the problem on its own terms. If we really hold both of those, hold that kind of contradiction, then actually something else can emerge in its place, a deeper understanding about the nature of the spiritual life. You have to sort of hold the disappointment and gratitude, because you can't condone certain actions and yet you can't dismiss him either. So it's quite an interesting, I think what I've found over the last year is that actually if people can really engage the uncomfortable nature of that process, they come out having learned something. I certainly have, actually. I've learned something about myself, you know, and about the nature of spiritual development. So yeah, so that's an example of making something a problem and not just a difficulty. But we can also just do this with everyday reactions we have. So I really love in Spooty's talk this Loch Ness monster image. It's like we think, you know, we're doing really well with a Buddhist practice. And then something happens and we react and the Loch Ness monster comes out. You know, and we don't know it's there until we react. So reactions are very useful, because in reactions we can see our basic self-clinging emerge. And we have to face that basic self-clinging. And in a way that's the natural consequence of integration and positive emotion, because we've started to take responsibility for our mental states and try and develop more positive mental states. Yes, it's helped us to own our own reactions and not just blame other people. And in owning our own reactions, we can reflect on them. I think the list that I use the most to reflect on my own reactions is the four modes of grasping. This is found on the Wheel of Life. The four modes of grasping is how we create an identity. How I create my sense of selfhood, my Atman. The first one is karma, which is likes and dislikes. I create my sense of self by defining what I like and what I dislike, don't like. So really it's I like, therefore I am. You know, I like cake, I don't like barley cup. I like rocket dog shoes, I don't like Crocs. I'm not the kind of person who wears Crocs. You know, and this is how we create ourselves all the time. I mean, honestly, who cares? So then something happens and we basically don't get what we like and we get what we don't like. And that's when our sense of identity is challenged. Or there's views. I have to say views are much more important to me than likes and dislikes. These are the kind of ways we create ourselves or our idea of ourselves by our opinions. I think, therefore I am. I think this, you know, and we can have this a lot in the Sangha. As the Sangha gets bigger, we're going to have to deal with people who think very differently to us, who vote very differently to us. You know, and of course the Brexit debate was quite a big thing in British centres, because it wasn't, and you know, a lot of Buddhists assumed that everyone would vote to remain, and they certainly did not. So, yeah, we're going to have to face that people think differently to us, and what happens when our views are challenged? Where's the sense of self there? says grasping after sila bata, which means rites and rituals, behaviour, which is basically I do, therefore I am. I think this is the biggest challenge to this is when we get ill. You know, so for example, when if I define myself by going through a run, you know, I am a kind of person that goes through a run, meditates, does the prostration practice, and then I get ill, and I can't meditate, and I can't go for a run, and I can't do the prostration practice. What happens to me then? Or, you know, when I'm with my family and my little daily ritual is challenged, you know, because the kids get up earlier than me, forget meditation. So, yeah, so it's I do, therefore I am. What happens when our behaviour, our kind of routine is challenged, or even our sense of sort of ethics, what we will do or what we won't do? And in certain situations, you know, you're going to be provoked to do things you can never imagine. I think mothers all know this. You know, you've got a nice identity at the Buddhist centre, and then you've got a teenage child, or the terrible twos. Or, I mean, for me, it's putting my nieces and nephews to bed when there's six of them all together. I wasn't friendly auntie then. Right, you, in there. Yeah. So, and then the other one is asavada, which I define really as roles. And I think this is very important, for us, you know, I am a doctor, I am a mother, I am a sister, I am a scientist, I am a whatever your job is. You know, I am a teacher, I am a counsellor. And what happens when you're not those things? You know, particularly if you retire. You know, people really go through some struggles sometimes when they retire because they're no longer I am the person who does this, you know, this is my role in life. So it's just useful to reflect how we build our sense of identity and which, in a way, we're most strongly clinging to as well. You know, which is the one that really gets us. You can take away my likes and dislikes much easier than you can challenge my views. That's what I've noticed. That's where I really come up against my reactivity. But if we can see through our reactions, if we can use the Dharma to reflect on our experience, we can see into reality, and this is where wisdom emerges. We see things as they really are. We see reality in its fullness. We see with pure view, the mirror-like wisdom, things as they are, without trying to hide, without trying to make things more palatable. We just see it as it is. So that's the cognitive level, the head, the way you reflect on reality. There's also the emotional level, the heart. And I remember once upon a time, I had this dream where I was walking down a long corridor and one of the doors was open. And I went into this door and in this room, it was a bit like... It was a dream room, so it was quite big, much bigger than you'd expect for the door, almost limitless. And there was Bhante sitting there, and he was contemplating an enormous red lotus, just made out of light, this enormous red lotus. And he didn't look at me, he just was looking very intently, but very relaxed, looking at this enormous lotus made out of red light. And I knew at that point that I didn't understand the nature of the red lotus, but I knew that he did, and I knew that was enough for me. So in Living with Kindness, Bhante talks about metta in a fully expansive mode as expanding out beyond the self. And so we can look at this way of approaching spiritual death and rebirth as the kind of radical edge of metta. It's the mind gone beyond definition, like a circle expanded into infinity. And he says it's the self as replaced by a creative orientation of becoming. So when Bhante's talking about spiritual death, he says it's openness in the direction of ultimate reality, not holding back on the process of expansion, not opening up so far, that is to say, opening up as regards to positive emotion, but then refusing to open up any further. So this way of approaching spiritual death and rebirth is actually about expanding the love beyond the gravitational pull of the self. Entering into the great mystery of the other, the path of love. As Hafiz says, the sea of love is a sea that has no shore. There you can only give up your soul. So what we do here is we ask ourselves, who falls off the edge of my metta-bhavana? You know, what limits am I putting on my metta? And really the limit there is, it's a sense of me giving metta to you. There's a sense of I sending metta to someone other, well wishing from self to other. But in this kind of approach to spiritual death and rebirth, what we're trying to do is we're seeing that actually this whole idea of sending metta to someone else is limited and in a way a little bit peculiar. Because it's not really about me sending metta to you, it's about actually mystery in relationship to mystery. And seeing that the boundaries between self and other are mind made, and what the mind creates, the mind can undo. So it's seeing, we can really experience this in the metta-bhavana, that there's a certain point where we realise we've created this division between us and the other person. And we've created an idea of who we think they are, and an idea of who we think we are. Actually, people are undefinable. They're growing, they're beautiful, they're magic, they're impermanent, they're not separate. And then you get into this state of, yes, mystery, responding to mystery. It's not even really about metta anymore in the sense of I'm going to send loving kindness to you. It's more a sort of contemplation of the mystery of self and other. And in spiritual rebirth, the Vimalakirti Nadesha calls this the great love, Maha Maitri. Because he says, in the love that sees the emptiness of construction of self and other, we see through the separateness of self and other. It frees love. It doesn't prevent love. No, if you see the emptiness of self and other, it doesn't mean we're cold to people. It's more like we are freeing that love so we can love truly without any impediment. There is just love. Bhante calls it the free-floating metta. Paramasambhava calls it the metta that arises with a ceaseless melody. So yes, so that's the emotional path. It's the path of love, going beyond separateness between self and other. But there's also the volitional aspect. So in Living Wisely, Bhante talks about the ego as a way of functioning. The ego is not a thing, it's a way of functioning. It's a sort of restricted, inward-looking way of functioning. And you don't need to get rid of the self. You need to transform the way you operate from a tight ball of self-interest to expansion without a centre. And he calls in enlightenment really infinite creativity. So what this means is basically becoming less selfish. We can't think our way out of the dichotomy between self and other. It will be, in a way, me thinking my way out of me. Because your thoughts are necessarily within the dichotomy of self and other. So what we need to do from this perspective is we need to act. So this path is also the path of responsibility. We do what is needed. You might remember the story of the Aniruddhas. Why should I not set aside what I want to do and do what they want to do? So yes, so this is the path of action. The path of actually moving towards other, away from our own sort of self-interest, towards other. And it doesn't mean that we deny our own needs. We also have to be part of the picture. I think it's more in terms of just being part of condition arising and not thinking about needs at all. I think the language of needs can be quite complicated, because actually what it's more about from this perspective is just doing what needs to be done. And it's not so important about whether it's what you need or what someone else needs. So I think this is particularly important in the order, and this is really what we're doing in the order as a path of practice. Because we're working together and seeing ourselves as a community and supporting each other in that community. And I think this is only possible if we feel we're serving a greater vision than ourselves, and that we're all sharing in that vision. If we're working on the same greater project in our different spheres. So what this requires is a sense that actually the order was founded by the Bodhicitta, working through Bhante. And that by serving the order and serving the Dharma, we're serving the Bodhicitta. And actually I do feel that. If I didn't feel that, I wouldn't be doing what I was doing, because, you know, you come up against endless frustrations in working with the order. And why would I bother to earn this amount of money for all this work if I didn't feel I was serving the Bodhicitta? You know, it's not serving the order in itself. It's serving a kind of greater vision of the raising of consciousness of humanity. And I think there's a magic in that. There's a magic in that, because in acting out this greater vision and working together, we reach a point where distinctions dissolve. Bhante says, we mustn't forget that to see reality in all things in the universe isn't enough. There also has to be that mutual recognition and enjoyment between creative individuals. So I think that's what happens when we're working together for a greater vision on ourselves. It's a mutual recognition and enjoyment between creative individuals. And we all feel, in the way, ideally, the order as practice is that you might be working in your own sphere, whatever your own sphere is, you know, Tiamatlaloka, Taraloka, a local centre, or working out in the world in various sort of altruistic projects. So you might feel like you're working within your own sphere, but that sphere is part of the greater project of the Bodhicitta. And if we can keep that vision alive, that our own sphere is working in line with the Bodhicitta, we can keep that sense of vision alive. So this is really rebirth as energy, spontaneous, compassionate activity, where we're not thinking in terms of self and other even anymore. We're just thinking of doing what needs to be done to serve the greater vision. And one can really experience a sort of flow in one's experience if we're in touch with this, which I have been in touch with this. You suddenly get this kind of burst of energy. The kind of energy that Bhante experienced in Nagpur after Ambedkar died, where you're just serving something bigger than yourself, and self and other just doesn't come into it, and you're not excluding yourself. It's just you're part of something much bigger, part of a bigger vision. So just to conclude, spiritual death asks us not just to integrate ourselves and go forward, or to purify and refine our experience, but also to look at this structure of experience itself and to unpack that structure. As a Sangha says, the nature of existence, is it empty or not? Merely feeling this doubt tears samsara asunder. Merely feeling this doubt tears samsara asunder. So even by questioning our structure of reality, we're tearing samsara asunder. And in the silence, we can, you know, which is coming up in a couple of days, we can really watch our mind, we can be receptive, we can look at our reactions, look at our sort of spiritual problems, if you like. We can expand our metta, and we can look for opportunities to serve from a place of greater vision. We could even feel ourselves in contact with just serving the greater love. So I'm going to, or surrendering to the greater love. So just imagine oneself as, how do I surrender to the greater love in this experience? So I'm just going to end with a song from the, or poem from the Theragata, which is the early songs of the Buddhist nuns. And this nun's called Chitta. She says, though I am thin, sick, and lean on a stick, I have climbed up vulture's peak, robe thrown down, bowl turned over, I leaned on a rock. Then the great darkness opened. I leaned on a rock. I leaned on a rock. The great darkness opened. It opened.